Welcome to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Radio, licensed in Bella Vista, California, and transmitting from Round Mountain. Here we explore the lives of triumphant humans who endure life's persistent challenges. Our guests are driven by passion and inspiration and live with a compelling sense of purpose. Their persistence, perseverance are brought on by tragic episodes or by wonderfully cradled lives. But for whatever reasons, guests will openly share their innermost feelings and beliefs that fuel their works. With determination, courage, and insistence, our guests are driven to put more into life than they take out. Please listen to these inspirational, triumphant human stories. And yes, I am Henry Cuenca. Today's guest, Vicky, is known by her sister as a disaster magnet. She not only grew up with her manic, depressive, schizophrenic mother, but survived the eye of Hurricane Hugo. In addition, she heeded evacuation declarations in two major historical fires. Her life moved on through childhood with many sicknesses. She had ulcers at the age of five. Treatment for anxiety, stress, and biofeedback therapy at age 12. And as if that wasn't enough, breast cancer at age 41. Through the influence of her father's resilience, deep spiritual connection, and gracious volunteering, Vicky gained advanced lessons on life. She put to use providing heartfelt fellowship to mentally ill and teaching good works to young children. Maybe these statements by her will set the tone for her vision. Everybody is worthy of love, and everybody has a place in this world. Please listen to this heartfelt story. Vicky Oney, welcome to today's show.
Hello. It's Vicky Ono.
Vicky Ono. Right. I did it again, didn't I? Vicky, why don't we start out by you providing us an overview of your current life?
Well, I'm currently a kindergarten teacher, and I love my job. I get to go to school every day and enjoy young people, very young people. They're 5 and 6 years old, and I enjoy their enthusiasm and their creativity and their zest for life.
Mm-hmm. Vicky, how long have you been teaching?
I've been teaching for 25 years.
5 years, that's a good spell. I know that you had a very difficult childhood life. And so can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
Well, I would say that I had some difficult spells in my childhood. I also had some very wonderful spells in my childhood. My mother suffered from hallucinations, paranoid schizophrenia, and manic depressive disorder. She attempted suicide a few times. I did have a great extended family that helped nurture us. My father was an extremely strong person who did his best to shelter us from the things my mother was manic or hallucinating about. My mother was also a very creative artist and scientist, and so some of
she was very intelligent.
She was very intelligent. Uh-huh. She was a biologist. We did lots of science. We did lots of art. We did lots of crafts. During the spells that she was at home, we did have some very good times mm-hmm. with our mom. So it wasn't all bad, but it was very stressful. Mm-hmm. My brother, who's a little bit less than 4 years older than me, he said that we had to learn to do a lot of things on our own. So the basics of taking care of a house were really left to us kids.
Mm-hmm. So how many children were in the family?
There are three of us.
Mm-hmm. A brother?
My brother's the oldest, my sister's in the middle, and I'm the baby.
Baby child. Mm-hmm. Tell us some of your most early recollections of the situation with your mother.
Well, my mother was, she was advised not to have any more kids when she had my sister. And so when I came along, it was just more than she could handle. So we went to my grandmother's Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother, who happened to be from Japan, was our major caregiver. When we were with her, things were, you know, we were well fed. We were well taken care of. When we were at home, my mom had two babies. My sister was one and I was just born. And so my mom couldn't carry us around and would tie a blanket around her belt and take us around the house, you know, like on a sled, on a blanket sled. We also
playfully, or
I don't recall it being playful. I remember when we were very small, which I was very small when we lived in Bakersfield.
Oh, so it was Bakersfield was
in
where,
Bakersfield.
Were you
yes.
Were you born in Bakersfield?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of us were born in Bakersfield, including my dad. My dad was Japanese American, second generation.
Mm-hmm.
So he was also born in Bakersfield. We moved from Bakersfield just before I turned six, when I was in kindergarten. So my recollections of Bakersfield were filled with animals because my mom pretty much had, we had all kinds of animals in the house. We incubated eggs for the zoo for alligators. So I was the only one I knew with baby alligators hatching at home. My mom thought that it was not okay to use bug spray and stuff like that. So she would buy chameleons and let them loose in the house. So we had lizards crawling on our curtains to eat the bugs, like flies and mosquitoes. That was kind of an odd thing to have at your house. Mm-hmm. And it made it so people didn't necessarily want to come over. We also hatched, we raised gopher snakes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. We had snakes.
Were they contained or did you let them run around?
No, they were contained and they were fun. I enjoyed the animals a lot. We also happened to have the endangered species of the desert tortoise living in our backyard because Bakersfield is part of their territory. So we had lots of fun with animals. Most of the time, from when I was small, I have pretty fun memories. I think, you know, my grandmother took care of us. And when we were home on the weekends, my dad did his best to take care of us. My dad did all of the cooking. Mm-hmm. And I think I had some aunts that helped out, too. Because my mother was already exhibiting some of her odd behaviors at that time.
So It sounds like there was a certain amount of contentment in your life. I mean, with your staying at your grandmother's, your father's resilience.
Yep.
It sounds with the lizards and the bugs.
Well, when you're a little kid, you love all that stuff.
Well, sure.
You don't think.
Well, that's
it's
the time
odd.
To learn to love it. Actually,
and when you're small, you think this is normal.
Right.
To have lizards loose in your house to eat the flies.
So did you, was your general sense that that things were okay?
I think most children think that this is okay, that everything is okay. You don't understand when you're small. Like my students, if they're in a poor situation at their house, they don't understand that that's a different, situation than what other children have. They don't really have the ability yet, as I did not when I was small, to understand that, you know, other mothers read them stories. You know, I didn't have the nursery rhymes or the stories read to me. My grandmother did sing to me in Japanese, and that was really cool. My grandmother did nursery rhymes in Japanese. So I remember that, and I remember family picnics and events that the extended family, which primarily lived in Bakersfield, that we had a lot of fun together. My cousins were the best. And our family had a nursery called Evergreen Nursery. And so when you've got a bunch of cousins and you've got a bunch of land full of trees and plants and greenhouse, we weren't supposed to go in there, but sometimes we did. And it was a fun place as a little kid. I do remember going to a preschool, which was attached to Bakersfield College when I was four. I wanted to go to elementary school with my sister because we're very close in age, plus, you know, whatever she was doing, I should be doing. But when she went to kindergarten, I didn't get to go. And I remember that because I really wanted to go, but I got to go to preschool instead, mm-hmm. which I had a lot of fun there.
When you were five, we said in the opening that in the fifth grade, I should say, that you were treated for anxiety and stress, mm-hmm. right? So even though it sounded like there was a normalization of a basically family unit with your grandfather, your grandmother, your grandparents, mm-hmm. and your father, so there was probably an undercurrent going on.
Well, a big change happened after we left Bakersfield.
Uh-huh.
When we moved to Fresno, I no longer had my grandmother watching me Monday through Friday.
And what precipitated the...
My father took a new job. Uh-huh. He was a city planner. So he took a new job in Fresno. And so we moved to Fresno, and I had to change kindergartens mm-hmm. to Mrs. Jones's class. And we no longer had family members, you know, picking us up from school and helping us.
So there was a break of...
Well, I missed my grandmother because I'd been with her for... since birth, basically, until I was almost 6 years old. And then all of a sudden, I was in a new city, didn't know the neighbors. You know, we had to get to know them.
Right.
So once we got to Bakersfield, once we got to Fresno, things kind of fell apart. Mm-hmm. And when I was in the December of my kindergarten year, which was about a month, maybe a month and a half after we moved mm-hmm. to Fresno, my mother attempted suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
And ended up in the state mental hospital.
Do you remember that?
You know, I don't remember the actual incident because mm-hmm. I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. I didn't witness it. My one of my good friends, who I'm still friends with to this day, she remembers finding my mother and told me about it. She's about 3.5 years older than me. And
so you were how old at the time?
I was just turning 6. Sorry. So when Mom was put in the state mental hospital in Stockton, then, of course, we didn't have – we had a housekeeper, I guess, that because I was on half-day kindergarten. And my sister and my brother would walk me home mm-hmm. and have lunch and then go back to school. So,
you endured many childhood sicknesses, bronchitis, stress, anxiety.
And I had pneumonia every year until I started school, evidently.
Really?
Because my mom and dad both smoked.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So.
Then your mother smoked a lot?
5 packs a day.
That was quite a bit.
Yes.
So she always had a cigarette in her.
She was a chain smoker. And uh-huh. Research has determined that for schizophrenics or people who are suffering from hallucinations, it's actually medicinal to smoke. Something in the cigarettes causes a reduction in the number of hallucinations or the
really?
Intensity of them. So many schizophrenics are addicted to nicotine or cigarettes.
Were they prescribed?
Not prescribed.
Uh-huh.
Later on, after a few stints in the state hospital when I was in high school, the doctors were trying to get my mother to quit smoking, and she had nicotine gum and nicotine patches and 5 packs a day, and she just kept on, mm-hmm. you know, with that.
Smoking.
Mm-hmm. So being – I was born really tiny because of Mom smoking during pregnancy, and then I was enclosed in the house with all of the cigarette smoke. So I was a very sickly kid. I have a lot of allergies, and mm-hmm. it's called reactive airway syndrome is what the doctors say now. So it's like having my airways react to, like, perfumes and things like that. But they also react to smoke very badly.
Mm-hmm.
So we were sick, my sister and I both. I think being stuck in the house was the main reason. Once I started school, then I got some fresh air at school. So I generally got bronchitis mm-hmm. every year, but not pneumonia.
I recall that you actually learned some visualization techniques.
Yes.
And I'd like you to tell us about that, but we've got to take a break right now, so we're going to be right back.
Okay, thanks.
Ooh,
If you are just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5 FM, listener-supported radio. And I am Henry Cuenca, and my guest today is Vicky Ono. And Vicky, before our break, we were going through the various and sundry childhood sicknesses that you endured, and you learned visualization techniques at a pretty young age. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I was pretty stressed out as a little kid and had really bad ulcers that they thought were caused by stress. And anyways, my family went to therapy together as family therapy, which was mandated by, I believe, the county, because my mother had gotten released from the state mental hospital mm-hmm. as the mental hospitals were being closed in California. Mm-hmm. And
that was during President Reagan's.
When Ronald Reagan uh-huh. was governor of California, uh-huh. he uh-huh. wanted to have counties take care of our mentally ill people instead of the state. Uh-huh. And so my mother, who was still suffering from mental illness, was returned to our home. So part of the process was that we went to family therapy. Uh-huh. And then in addition to that, because I was suffering from illnesses, anxiety illnesses with my stomach, lots of pain in my stomach, bleeding, ulcers, and so forth. I went to the child therapy unit at, I don't know for sure, but it was probably Valley Children's Hospital.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. And then they referred me to some psychiatrists or psychologists, I don't know which, at Fresno State. Uh-huh. And Fresno State had a program where they were teaching me how to calm down. How to get my – I was never overtly or outwardly anxious. I seemed mm-hmm. like a pretty normal person. Mm-hmm. And I internalized all of that stress mm-hmm. and caused myself physical harm because of internalizing that stress mm-hmm. is what I was told. So we did visualization exercises with calming music. I also did biofeedback therapy mm-hmm. where I could watch little dials to see how these different electrodes were reacting so that I could physically and mentally calm myself
and
down.
And what kinds of things did you visualize to calm yourself down?
Well, they would lead me through visualization exercises like pretend or imagine, you know, I would lay down calmly in a quiet place with the person who was leading me and teaching me these techniques, mm-hmm. You know, visualize an ocean, for example.
Waterfalls.
Water, yeah. lots of water, mm-hmm. lots of calming places. I had a lot of anxiety about traffic mm-hmm. where, you know, I thought I was going to get hit by a car. I mm-hmm. remember that was one of the things that scared me. And part of that, I think, was because we did a lot of walking around by ourselves back then, like walking home from school with your sister who's six and your, or I guess my sister was seven and I was turning six when my sister was walking me home from school. And we had to cross a busy street. So, you know, I think not having my mom there to take care of us created a lot of this anxiety in me.
Did this anxiety spread over to your brother and sister?
I don't think so. I think my brother was 4 years older, so he was more independent and out mm-hmm. with his buddies. Mm-hmm. And I think I needed my mother more since I was much younger.
I see.
And
I would assume your brother maybe connected a little bit more with your father?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. You know, I know my brother is a very independent, creative person. Mm-hmm. And I was very shy. I wasn't that outgoing as a little kid. Mm-hmm. So I think I needed to be nurtured more. And I don't right. think I got enough of that nurturing. Mm-hmm.
I know that you had mentioned that your mother had published papers at age 13.
Yes.
Which is pretty remarkable. Given what you've been telling us about your mother, can you give us more information on these papers that she had published?
Well, my mom was published at 13, had something to do with bugs and insects. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what, uh-huh. but my mother's, I think it was her uncle or her great uncle, was also a scientist, and he was an entomologist. And mm-hmm. so my mom was raised learning about bugs mm-hmm. from her family member, mm-hmm. and then she was doing research, you know, as a kid along
at
with
13
him.
13 years old,
and was published.
That's amazing, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yep.
Absolutely amazing.
She was, my aunt, her older sister, had figured out that my mom, she was, you know, a very, very brilliant person. And oftentimes with the schizophrenia comes high intelligence. Mm-hmm. And being that bright but socially not connected with other people very well was one of my mother's hallmarks of her on her, you know, soon to be developing schizophrenia. She had hallucinations which repeated through her life that we as kids became familiar with, as adults we became more familiar with them, so that when she was going to have a really bad episode and she started talking about certain things, we could tell, oh, Mom, you need to go see your psychiatrist again, go see your shrink and get some help.
Vicki, your mother had challenges, obviously, but she also had some really positive aspects to her that she brought forth. In retrospect, what is the one single thing that you think that you learned or you picked up from your mother that has helped you endure your life or progress in your life?
Well, my mom used to use the phrase, always remain a child inside. Mm-hmm. My mother was pretty religious, and she said, we're all children of God. Mm-hmm. And she would say, always remain a child inside. Always keep your wonder. Mm-hmm. Always be questioning and be able to say, ah, and enjoy the beauty of small things. My mother... well, as a family, we did a lot of traveling around by car and camping. Mm-hmm. Even when my mother was in the state hospital, we would drive up there on a regular basis and visit her up in Stockton. I remember the road trips to go see her from Fresno were fun. We would drive down the road and have a good time, and as my brother and sister and I with my dad, singing in the car because we had no car radio. Mm-hmm. And then we would visit my mom. And on occasion for, like, school vacations, my dad could check her out of the state hospital and we could go on trips. Mm-hmm. So we would go camping and we would do science and we would do arts and we would do crafts. And my mom was a very creative person. She did a lot of painting even as a as an adult. And her paintings were sold in Fresno. And they were pretty – some of them were pretty odd, reflecting some of her imaginary things that she was hallucinating about, too.
Van Gogh.
Yeah.
Let's switch a little bit.
Never lacked in art supplies at our house.
Let's talk about your father. I mean, he was the column that apparently held the family together. So tell us about your father.
Well, my dad was born in Bakersfield, and
he's the one that knew Merle Haggard, did he not?
He did not know him. He went to the same high school. He's actually he
was with Merle Haggard.
No, Merle Haggard was younger than my father. My youngest uncle was in the same year as Merle Haggard, but my father is older.
Oh, I see.
Than Merle Haggard by I think 10 or 11 years, something like that. But they went to the same high school. And so, anyways, Dad was. He was an activist. He taught us about volunteering. He was, being the oldest of his siblings, he was the one who could speak Japanese the best.
Can you speak Japanese?
I studied Japanese.
Uh-huh.
I did not speak Japanese as a child. I think I probably spoke Japanese as a little kid since my grandmother took care of me Monday through Friday. But I don't remember speaking Japanese as a little kid. I studied it when I went to college, and I studied in Japan for a year to improve my Japanese language skills because I wanted to be able to talk to my grandmother about things more than just a little kid says, like, have your snack and you better go to the bathroom before you get in the car, you know, little things like that that grandmothers tell their kids to do. So I actually studied Japanese as an adult.
You know, we're going to have to take a another break right now, and so we're going to be back in just 1 minute. Thank you. You are listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Supported Radio. And I am Henry Cuenca, and I'm speaking with our guest, very special guest today, Vicky Ono. Ono, you were telling us about your father being the structure of the company, of the family. He was a landscaper, right?
He was a city planner, and he was also a landscape architect.
Uh-huh. In those early days, he must have been one of the first that ever received a certification for landscaping.
Yes, his landscape architecture number was 56.
56.
And he was very proud of that fact.
Well, I think he should be. So he did a lot of planting, obviously, right?
We were with him many times putting in irrigation systems. He volunteered a lot. He helped with low-income housing for farm workers, and then we would go along with him and, you know, do the groundbreakings, and then when the housing was open, go to the fiestas, we would help. I didn't have to dig trenches. I think that was because I'm a girl, and I was a little girl at the mm-hmm. time, but my brother would help, and we would put in irrigation systems, and we did the landscaping for the church that we went to, mm-hmm. and we were always active.
Well, your father being an activist, it sure sounds that way. You had mentioned that your mother left with you a sense of spirituality about God and odd and small things. Did you folks go to church?
We were regulars at the Methodist Church in Fresno, uh-huh. and also in Bakersfield before we moved to Fresno. We were my grandfather, my dad's father, had come to the United States and worked for the Santa Fe Railroad. And he figured out that the people who were successful at raising money to send back to Japan, which was what he was in America to do, mm-hmm. were the ones who went to church. Mm-hmm. And so my grandfather was the first one to become a Christian and join the Methodist Church.
Now, your grandfather was born in Japan.
My grandfather was born in Japan. Uh-huh. He came to the United States with his father, my great-grandfather, uh-huh. and they worked for the Santa Fe Railroad in Bakersfield. And there was a Japanese Methodist mission church in Bakersfield.
So they went to Christianity when they got here in the United States.
Right. And my grandfather remained an active member of the church. Mm-hmm. He came back to the United States and decided this was where he wanted to settle and raise his family. And I think it's kind of interesting that when my grandmother came to, they got married in Japan and then she came to the United States also. Their first child was my dad, and they named him American Boy, written in Japanese, of course, so his name was Yoneo. He was always active. He believed in staying active in your community. Mm-hmm. One of the things my dad taught me was that you can't really complain unless you're going to do something about it.
Boy, I like that.
So no whining, no complaining.
I like that.
If something's bothering
We can go to press with that.
get busy on it.
In other words, accept things as they come to you, right?
Well, but if you don't accept the way it is,
write
to your politicians.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Get
yeah.
active.
Right.
Go to a march.
Absolutely. So you say he was an activist. Did he pick that up from your grandfather? Or where did that ingredient come from?
I think that probably started after he was put in an internment camp.
Yes.
Yeah. His time in the internment camp was primarily his senior year of high school.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the internment camp. Some of our listeners may not know of the internment camp and how it was connected to the Second World War. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the internment camp.
Well, if you were of 1/16th Japanese ancestry, then you were locked up in a prison camp
right.
during World War II.
Right.
Beginning in 1942, they started first with the biggest cities, and then the Central California farmers, which my family were farmers, leasing land outside of Bakersfield, they were locked up last because, you know, being farmers, they didn't really have any threat. My aunt was only a month old, and she certainly wasn't a threat to the United States of America. So the Japanese American people were locked up away from their homeland, or their homeland was California, Oregon or Washington.
It was over 100,000 Japanese Americans that were interned.
120,000 people were put into prison camps based on their race. And so my father's experience, he was a Boy Scout. He wanted to become an Eagle Scout. He wanted to go to UC Berkeley. All of those dreams were stopped because of the United States government. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably where my dad learned that I've got to do something. Mm-hmm. And then thankfully the Quaker Church sponsored people to leave the camps. If they finished high school in camp, they couldn't go back to California to go to college. So the Quakers sponsored Japanese American young people to leave the camps. Within the camp,
they sponsored
them? They would take them out of the camps. See, any Japanese American living outside of a certain parallel in California were free. So my Uncle Frank, who married my aunt, who was from Bakersfield, he was in Colorado, and he was never put into an internment camp because he lived in Colorado.
So it was principally the West Coast, because I know that in California, they enumerate the counties and the number of Japanese that were put mm-hmm. in internment. But I noticed that there were only certain counties in California.
It was a parallel. I forget which line of longitude it is, but uh-huh. anyone to the west of that was considered to be too close to the Pacific Ocean.
Right, right.
And then they were locked up in internment camps. Right. Even people who were half Japanese, like there's a gentleman in Reading named Dennis Bambauer. He was taken out of an orphanage in Los Angeles and put in an internment camp in Manzanar because he was 50% Japanese ancestry. Right. He didn't even know he was a 50% Japanese ancestry because he had never met his birth mother. So it was a completely racist act.
Yeah, no, there's no question.
The people were taken out of wherever they were and forcibly removed and put into pretty horrible conditions.
Oh, absolutely. So tell us the process. Okay, Pearl Harbor happened, right? Mm-hmm. Within hours or days, there's already a strategy to get all American Japanese and put them somewhere, right?
Well, I don't think it was within hours and days. The first thing that happened was leaders of the Japanese community and the Japanese American community were locked up first. Uh-huh. So people who were in larger cities, I mean, Bakersfield didn't have that big of an impact because there weren't a lot of people in Bakersfield of Japanese uh-huh. ancestry. Uh-huh. Los Angeles, San Francisco, those people were affected bigger mm-hmm. or faster, I should say, mm-hmm. and more harshly. Some people were taken away within hours after Pearl Harbor.
So tell me, in your specific family, were you homeowners? Were your grandparents and homeowners?
No, they were not allowed to purchase land.
Prior to
Pearl Harbor, I'm not sure what year. I wish I knew the year. I should have looked it up. Because there's a certain year that the U.S. government passed a law saying that anyone of Asian ancestry cannot buy land, okay. cannot be a landowner.
So undoubtedly.
So my family leased their farmland.
For that specific reason.
Because they were not allowed to either. It was illegal to become an American citizen. Uh-huh. So even though my grandparents wanted to become American citizens, they could not. Mm-hmm. It was illegal to buy land if you were of Asian ancestry, right. East Asian ancestry, so Chinese, uh-huh. Japanese. Mm-hmm. There was an exclusion act.
Right.
So in 1924, all of a sudden, anyone from Asia could not immigrate to the United States either.
Right.
All of those things have, of course, because of the Civil Rights Act, are null and void.
Right.
My grandparents could not purchase the land that they leased to farm on.
But there undoubtedly were situations where Japanese or Asians owned property.
Yes.
And what happened to those people when the cloak came down and says, you're being interned? What happened to their property?
Well, most people, if they came to the United States earlier than my grandparents uh-huh. did, they were buying land
right.
and they were able to buy farmland. And there were some great communities of farmers in the uh-huh. Central Valley.
Right.
Some people in San Francisco owned their homes, mm-hmm. for example. When it became known that they were going to be locked up, people were selling what they had for next to nothing.
It wasn't confiscated.
Well, they were able to sell it if they could,
right.
But it's like having a sale that everybody knows.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
They just had to walk away from some of their things.
Right.
We were very fortunate because my family lived in Bakersfield, and the Bakersfield United Methodist community, which I think it was Wesley, and I'm not sure. But anyways, the Japanese families, because there was a Japanese Methodist mission church there, they were approached by the churches in Bakersfield, and they were offered the opportunity to store their belongings at the churches.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of losing everything, my family chose wisely and kept some of the belongings that were from Japan,
mm-hmm.
that they treasured, so they didn't actually lose everything. In many ways, my family was luckier than most.
What benefits, if there are benefits, or what outcomes derive from your father's perspective after being interned? And he was interned for how long?
He was incarcerated for, well, interned, I guess. He was not he was a prisoner of the United States government from the spring of 1943 until sometime in the summer of, or I'm sorry, 1942 until sometime in 1943,
mm-hmm.
when he was sponsored by Quakers to leave the camp. He had mm-hmm. finished high school. His high school was actually a great experience in the internment camp because all of a sudden some of his teachers were UC Berkeley professors who were also interned in internment camps.
Oh my goodness sakes,
who were Japanese Americans born and raised in California, but were older than he was and were professors at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, he got a better education in camp for his senior year than he would have gotten in Bakersfield,
mm-hmm.
where they were tracking all of the students of color to be mechanics. He was being tracked to become a mechanic. And instead, he was able to get really good coursework from his professors who were his now high school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
The Quakers also sent many teachers to the internment camps. There were 10 internment camps in the United States, and people volunteered to be teachers in those camps because all of a sudden you had children as young as being born in the camps to ready to finish high school in the camps that didn't have any teachers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a wonderful idea that the Quakers saw a need to
mm-hmm.
to support and help.
Yes.
Isn't that tremendous?
Oh, I'm so grateful.
Absolutely.
I'm so thankful because my dad's eyes were opened bigger than Bakersfield by getting teachers from all over the United States
mm-hmm.
as his high school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And then fortunately, the Quakers sponsored him to leave the camp. He was able to speak at Quaker meeting houses around the United States. He was also able to go to the University of Connecticut, UConn, accepted Japanese Americans at in-state tuition rates because
mm-hmm.
these were stateless people. My dad could not return to California until after the war
mm-hmm.
in 1945 when the mm-hmm. camps were closed.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to return to California after World War II was over. So he met my mom at UConn.
I see.
If he had not gone to UConn, I wouldn't be here today.
tell me, did your father hold any grudges?
I think my father's sense of what freedom was changed dramatically. He actually wrote a piece when he was a senior in high school that was published years later about, you know, you believe in this freedom, you believe in America.
Mm-hmm.
He believed in America. He believed in the American dream. He was raised as a Boy Scout. He wanted to see the American dream and have that for himself and his family, and then he was locked up because of his race.
Mm-hmm.
So he was unable to speak about it, as pretty much anyone in the family. They talked about camp. When we were children, we thought, oh, they're talking about camp. They must be talking about Y camp. We go to Y camp. You don't realize when you're a little kid that when your aunts and uncles are all talking about camp, they're talking about being locked up because of their race.
Right.
So he didn't hold grudges. But he was unable to talk about it until the United States government actually apologized.
And what president apologized?
Well, Clinton started and there was a process. The Japanese American Citizens League worked hard to get an apology from the United States government and acknowledgement that even the Supreme Court back in the 40s, they were challenged by Fred Korematsu, who said, it's unconstitutional to lock me up because of my race.
Of course.
And the Supreme Court upheld the internment of the Japanese Americans. That was reversed by the Supreme Court sometime in the 90s.
You're very knowledgeable about this.
I don't know what year. I wish I did. So I'm not a history book. And anyways, the apology was there was a written apology. President Bush actually sent a letter, and there was an offer of redress. Mm-hmm. So the Japanese Americans were offered a redress of $20,000 per person after the United States government acknowledged that wrong was done
to them. Right.
And that after that apology, my father was able to go and talk in classrooms.
Oh, wonderful.
About the experience.
Uh-huh. And where was the internment camp that he was in?
The farm communities of the Central Valley were selected specifically to go to the Colorado River area internment camps. Mm-hmm. And it came out many, many years later. It was unknown at the time. But they waited and set up the internment camps on those Indian reservations in Arizona, and they used the farm workers' knowledge to irrigate those valleys. Mm-hmm. And then that land became valuable. Mm-hmm. And then some of that land was sold out from under the Indians and became beautiful farmland because of you might say slave labor, but they got small wages for doing the farm, for creating the irrigation systems, digging the ditches, and setting up the Colorado River area along both Poston in Arizona, which is where my dad was.
That was the internment camp?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Poston had some almost 17,000 prisoners, I guess, right?
It was the largest.
It was the largest, right?
Internment camp, yes.
That's a lot of people to house in the desert.
There were two Poston camps, and I think it was over 20,000 people in the middle of nowhere. Freezing cold winters, lots of sand and dust storms. My aunt Tycho had talked about the sand and dust storms coming through, and they'd come right through the cracks in the little 10 by 10 rooms that the whole family had to live in together.
You know, I've known Japanese, other Japanese that were interned. Mm-hmm. And one thing that really settles in on me is that I know these people pretty well, and there was never a sense of anger or revenge. And it wasn't something that they really would talk about a lot, but you could just tell that there was – if there was resentment, I think they contained it really deeply, but – for the most part, I don't think that there was, I would say, that they didn't hold any grudges or resentment.
Well, resentment and revenge are damaging to the
Absolutely
person who
they
has
are.
The resentment and revenge. And that's something that we learned as children. There's a lot of talk about, well, in Japanese, it's shigata ganai, which means there's nothing you can do about it. It's in the past.
Right.
It's kind of like the saying, water under the bridge. You can't keep dwelling on what went wrong and what's awful. Mm-hmm. There was definitely things that went wrong. You lose your freedom. You lose your livelihood.
Sure. Well, my goodness sakes,
you
absolutely.
You are stuck in the middle of nowhere in a desert.
Right.
My uncle Joe was a great baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
And so my uncle Joe was they actually had baseball teams, and there was actually a Japanese American baseball league that he got to play after the war. He got to travel and play baseball.
Right. Vicki, we're going to have to take another short break. Okay. You are listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Supported Radio. And I am Henry Cuenca here with my guest, Vicky Ono. And we were talking about her father's internment. And I guess, Vicky, I'd like to ask, what is it that the most that you took away from your father?
Well, my father was a very positive person. Mm-hmm. And he believed in forgiveness and he believed in moving forward. Mm-hmm. You learn from your past. We do need to study history. We do need to know our past. But we don't need to live in our past, and we don't need to live with blaming others. So if you're ready to move forward, you become active and you make yourself who you want to be. My dad believed that we could be whoever we want to be. And he encouraged us to, you know, search out what role we have on this earth. And if we feel like we're going the wrong way, change course. Anything's possible. My dad believed anything is possible. Bad things happen to good people.
Absolutely.
You pick it up and you
it's
keep
life.
On going.
Absolutely.
You don't live with resentment. He didn't have resentment about the internment camps.
Right.
Especially once the United States government acknowledged that they had made a mistake.
Vicky, you had cancer at 41.
Yes.
Please share with us that experience.
Well, I knew I was at risk for breast cancer.
And why was that?
My aunt, whom everybody when I was a little girl said, "Oh, you're just like Aunt Connie." I resemble my Aunt Connie. I guess my personality resembles my Aunt Connie. Mm-hmm. My Aunt Connie was a painter. I spent a summer at her house, which was a wonderful summer, mm-hmm. with my cousin Andy. I think I was 14 years old. When my mother's illness became worse, my dad would find places for us to be, mm-hmm. so we wouldn't spend our vacations at home with her. Mm-hmm. So I got to spend a summer vacation at my Aunt Connie's in Michigan. She got breast cancer. I think I was a college student at the time. And it was a big shock to the family.
Sure.
So when you have somebody that, as a kid, everybody says you're just like her, you start thinking, oh, am I really just like her? Am I going to become sick? So I was careful doing breast self-exams on a regular basis. I had had several funny lumps and was 33 when I had my first lump removed, mm-hmm. and I think I was 35 or 6 when I had my next lump removed. Mm-hmm. And then it was my third time that I found a lump that I was going, this one feels more like a marble. Something's different. So I already had a breast cancer specialist. They were mm-hmm. already doing mammograms, keeping mm-hmm. an eye on me. And thankfully, doing the breast self-exams, I found it myself. Breast cancer, when you're younger and premenopausal, can sometimes be masked on mammograms. It doesn't show up as well mm-hmm. because of the density of the breast tissue of younger women. So thankfully, I found it myself. I went to see my doctor, and she was fantastic and helped take care of things right away. It was a shock to my system, a shock to my body, you know, to have to go through surgery, reconstructive surgery,
sure,
chemotherapy, all of that when I was very young.
Now, every October, you approach women.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, I figure in October, as a survivor.
This was when you were aware that you had cancer.
Well, actually, I first found the lump in like February.
Oh, I see.
It wasn't in October, uh-huh. but I did my self exams regularly
uh-huh.
as part. You know, I had one of those things hanging in my shower that you can get when you go to. Like when they light up the bridge pink, mm-hmm. they give all the women the opportunity to feel.
Right.
Fake little breasts so you can feel like what a lump would feel like. You also get your hanging thing to put in the shower that reminds you to do your self-exams. Right. So anyways, my 20-year cancerversary is coming up in April.
Mm-hmm.
But every October, because there's that Breast Cancer Awareness Month, I ask any woman I run into, do you do your self-exams? Because if I was not doing my self-exams, I probably wouldn't be sitting here
today. And what is the reaction of most women?
they're like, they kind of look at me like, surprise. I said, well, I have permission because I saved my own life.
Good for you. Good for you.
And I don't know if anyone I've ever approached, like the lady at the post office or anyone has ever gone, oh, I got to go do my self-exams.
Yeah, right.
But self-exams do save lives.
Well, obviously. I mean,
yeah.
You're a living testimony,
exactly.
I guess. You know, we're running a little bit close to the end of the show, and I do want to talk about your works. Your works with the homeless?
Well, not necessarily homeless. Some of the people that I've worked with, I help run a outreach called Inclusive Ministries.
Inclusive Ministries.
Inclusive Ministries. Mm-hmm. And what it is that we have a dinner, which is primarily potluck. People volunteer to bring in foods. We have a fund to pay for the main dish. The next one's going to be Thanksgiving dinner, of course. And I have some fantastic cooks who come in and bring all of the sides. And then I have fantastic volunteers who go pick up people at their homes for mentally ill people, either group homes, and there are some really nice independent living facilities for people mm-hmm. suffering from mental illness. Mm-hmm. These people we've gotten to know over the years, they're great people. Mm-hmm. And monitoring mentally ill people is something that helps. You know, having other people besides their own little social group, having people that are outside of their little group home, see them on a regular basis, helps them to stay healthy. Mm-hmm. And they love coming in for a sing-along. My husband leads the sing-along.
Oh, my goodness sakes, wonderful.
His name's Greg Lawson. He's a teacher also. Mm-hmm. And he leads a great sing-along. And then we have great volunteers who come and we make a fantastic dinner.
And how often do you
do
this?
And they're so thankful.
How often do you?
Every month, except for the summer months. It's basically the school year.
Uh-huh,
we do
I
it
see.
For the school year.
And do you bring the invite homeless people that are living?
Anybody who walks in that wants to come is welcome uh-huh, because uh-huh. we include everybody.
Right.
And that's why it's called Inclusive Ministries.
Mm-hmm.
The contacts we have for going to pick people up and bring them are through the mental health care workers here in Reading.
Uh-huh.
And so we have some regulars that we've known for 10 years.
Right.
And we've had a few people pass away, and
sure.
we've done their memorial services for them
oh,
also.
Wonderful. Good for you.
It's really fun, and it's a joyous
It's got to be very gratifying, right?
Well, I know for myself, my mother was helped by people who cared
right.
and knew she had struggles, but also right. helped keep an eye on her. Mm-hmm. Even when my sister and I and my brother were grown and not in Fresno any longer, there were people that were helping my mother along, picking her up and taking her to Bible study,
mm-hmm.
picking her up and taking her to the Methodist women's group.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she was odd, she was still loved.
But aren't we all really odd one way or another?
We all have our quirks, that's for sure.
You know, I had asked you your vision early on, and you said everybody is worthy of love and everybody has a place in the world. And I can see the steps through the experiences that you've had from your very, very, very early ages, the endurances that you went through, that would cause one to create a vision like that. Right.
Oh, I truly believe it.
Oh, I know you do. There's no yeah. question. No question.
Everyone. And I don't believe there's any mistakes. Every child that has come into my classroom, every single one of them is a wonderful child. I love them all. And I want them to know that they can become who they want to be. They have to have expectations and a vision. And I hope as a teacher I can help them have good expectations and a vision of what kind of person they want to be. And through Inclusive Ministries, I hope that I help people feel like they're loved. And I do feel like we have a connection when we get together and we serve them dinner.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do.
I mean, mainly the
part of humanity.
Yeah, what I love to do.
Right. You also have been involved in a cherry blossom tree planting.
Well, we're hoping to plant some cherry blossom trees and bring that beauty to Reading. We have a pretty newly formed Japan Society of Shasta County, which mm-hmm. is made up of people like myself that have been to Japan. I studied in Japan and I taught in Japan so that I could learn Japanese, so that I could speak to my grandmother about things bigger than what a little kid knows.
How old were you when you went to Japan?
The first time I went to Japan, I was 19. for one school year. It was for college, and mm-hmm. then I went again as a college, after college, I went and taught there for a year. Mm-hmm. Anyways, our group is comprised of people who are from Japan, who now have settled in Reading. We mm-hmm. have people who have a great interest in Japan, some of the people who have been translators that live in town, some people who are into martial arts. Our goal is to plant cherry blossom trees in Reading to mm-hmm. be able to bring that beauty here.
Like the White House.
Like we have in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've been there for the Washington, D.C.
Oh,
Cherry
really?
Blossom Festival, uh-huh. and it's phenomenally beautiful. Mm-hmm. The concept of a cherry blossom is it lives a short life of great beauty, and we need to appreciate that great beauty in that moment that it is at its peak and go, ah, and then know that it will come again.
Sure.
And we're hoping that we can get some cherry blossom trees planted. We have a slight fund, and we're ready to plant some.
So you need some authorization. I've been
in contact with the city and mm-hmm. with the county and with a few schools in town to see if we could plant some groves of cherry blossom
trees. Do you have any locations that you've...
We're hoping to plant some along the Sacramento River.
Uh-huh.
We're hoping to plant some at some school sites. I think Sequoia School would be beautiful along the canal there. You could see it when you get off of the freeway,
mm-hmm.
off of 44, and you're heading down Park Marina this springtime. That would be gorgeous to have some
Is there a certain variety of cherry tree that you'd plant, or are these fruit-bearing?
They're not fruit-bearing. Uh-huh. They're for blossoms. I know fruit-bearing trees would be great, but they do make quite a big mess.
Yeah, they do,
and
if they're not picked.
Yes, if they're not picked. These right. are – the sakura trees are for the pizzazz and the explosive beauty of the blossoms.
Right.
I don't know if you know this, but in Japan, it's like the leaf peepers in New England – it goes, you know, they forecast it on the news.
Oh, they do.
Where is the peak right now? I think we could have some tourism up here for
we could add to the tourism. Vicki, we're getting to the close of our show, and I just wanted to say, is there anything that you would like to close with saying?
Well, I think that when bad things happen, good things are coming.
Mm-hmm.
When I had a pretty rough childhood. I'm a much stronger person because of that. I'm a much better teacher because my mother did lots of arts and crafts and fun things with us.
Bugs,
lizards. Lots of bugs. I love bugs, lizards, reptiles. I love science. When I had cancer and things were pretty awful for a couple of years there, I ended up, you know, surviving that 20 years later. I've got a fantastic husband, a great life, and I'm just going to keep on going one foot in front of the other.
Well, good for you. And Vicki, it's been a real pleasure in having you on our show today. Very, very much, and I appreciate all of your time. We're going to be closing here. You have been listening to community-supported KKRN 88.5 FM. We are supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. Are you ready to support your local community radio? To become a listener supporter, go to our website, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button, or mail a check to Post Office Box 188 Montgomery Creek, California. You can call 530-337-1101 to volunteer at KKRN Community Radio or to learn more. Thank you for listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show, where we are in earnest working to make our community and our world a better place. Please tune in to my show each first and third Tuesday of each month at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, where you will listen to another triumphant human story. I would love to hear from you, so please send me an email at henry@kkrn.org or call me directly at 530-356-9811. Thank you for listening.